I really like that song. Welcome to the American Legion Show. And I think we're going to do right now. Let me go here. Stop the music. There you go. Maybe that song is What's Up by Bob James, the genius keyboardist, musician of the 80s, 70s and 80s. He wrote Taxi, by the way, which is a fantastic, fantastic show. Sitcom. So anyway, tonight's guest will be Mr. Perry Drake. We expect him to come on sometime soon, and he will join us, and we will talk about him and his life and his career and his aspirations coming up. I know what they are, and you don't. So let's see where this is going. So we have, you'll like this guest. You'll like this a lot. So I don't know why that resolution changed with the trash. Okay, I think we have, let's go here. Yes, this here we have. That's a stream.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
It's a success. Welcome to the program.
I'm glad to be on the program. Thank you.
Yeah, I was just rambling on about the guests. So you're here finally.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was a little bit late. I'm not that computer literate. My daughter came home. I'm like, I don't know how to get on this. She said, you have Safari on your phone. It came with it. Just do it. So I finally figured it out.
No, I think it was me and my the time thing, you know, back and forth.
Yeah, we got screwed up, but we're fine. We're fine.
Yeah. Well, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Mr. Perry Drake, you know, I've seen you on Facebook many times before I actually talked to you. And I know we have a lot of the same mutual friends.
Right.
And we run in the same circles, conservative blacks, if you want to call it that.
Yes.
If you want to call it that.
Very much so.
Right. So, you know, I grew up as a military brat. So it was all about the USA all the time, 24/7, right. You know, as national anthem and everything. But how did you become a conservative?
You know what? I was always a conservative from the day I was born, but I didn't know it. I thought I was liberal.
Right.
And then my first newspaper job and radio station job was in Tuskegee, Alabama, of all places.
Mm.
And I ran into two guys who were at Tuskegee University who formed a Black Republican Conservative Club. Now, that was outlandish. This is back in the 80s. And so when we became friends and we would talk, and through talking, I would say something, then they would ask me to prove the things I said. Bit by bit, I realized I had always been conservative. I was born conservative. And most Black people are. That's the most frustrating
thing. Yeah, you're right.
They're very, when you go point by point with Black people, they're conservative. But yet, for some reason, there's something in them that makes them refuse to accept that. And I was like, well, I ain't going to be like that. So then I became a conservative. I worked in newspapers for 20 years. I was the only black male conservative, actually the only conservative, and it became a nightmare at times.
Right, yeah.
That's my journey to become a conservative.
So explain, okay, so how unique is a black conservative? Let's talk about that for a second. How rare is that? Or do you think, because you see people grow up conservatively and their parents, their family and everything, but then they turn, you know, a lot of blacks turn liberal for whatever reason.
Liberal.
Yeah.
I think that for a lot of black people, there's this desire to get back at white people.
Really?
There really is. You know, and that came out of the civil rights movement because it started out as a movement to make black people equal under the law, but then it morphed into universal equality. That if I'm not equal to you, then somehow I'm being discriminated against. Well, that's what black people wrestle with all the time. So you can show them the absolute truth, and they refuse to accept it. Why? Because in their minds, they gotta get back at white people.
Interesting. Very interesting.
But it is.
Yeah, right.
I worked in newsrooms for 20 years. Frequently, I took on the entire newsroom. And of course, it was me, the only black male, and all the rest, except for a couple of black females, all the rest of them were white people. And I used to take on the newsrooms night after night after night. I got written up so many times, I can't even count. But wow. They were afraid to fire me because you can't fire your only black editor. So yeah. I kind of use that to my advantage.
Yeah, who else is going to go into the black people neighborhood and do the reporting?
And besides, could you imagine defending that lawsuit?
Right, right.
Black reporter, Mac Mellon Porter, and you fired him?
Yeah, you can.
What did he do, shoot somebody in the newsroom?
Right, right, right.
No, he just expressed an opinion we disagreed with.
So, okay, so like when you're, let's talk about this. When you're African-American, you have like, it's almost like you're a protected class now on the news channels. Mm-hmm. And they send them to all the assignments that, you know, that they're suited for. And, you know, you always have to be, you represent things that are stereotyped.
Right.
And that's the way they roll. I mean, it's kind of like racist. You know, you should be able to do whatever story as a person. What are your thoughts on that? I know you did that for a living. Did you feel that way?
Yeah. I remember once I did feel that way. I was supposed to go cover the black stories, which, you know, I would turn in a 15-inch story and it would be briefed. I was like, what the hell y'all send me out there for?
Right.
One day there was this court case, and I worked for the New York Times newspaper, doesn't exist anymore, the newspaper in Georgia, Atlanta, Georgia. And it was this court case that involved some black people. What it was, it lost the memory. But what happened was, as I was going in to take over for the reporter, a white guy named Scott Marshall, I'll never forget. As I was going into the courtroom to take over to me, he stopped me and he said, look, the newsroom wants you to know that we're not sending you here because these are black. This is a trial with black people and you're black. Right. I looked at Scott and I'm like, why the hell would you feel the need to even say that?
Right.
I mean, why? I'm a reporter. I'm going to cover this story. That was the beginning of my downward spiral for 20 years. As a, you know what? It is. See, a lot of people think that the press is liberal out of philosophy. And that's not true. I work with these people and I know them, as the great Rush Limbaugh used to say, like every inch of my glorious naked body. And what I would tell people is they are not principled. They are ignorant. That's what they are. That when you meet people they're stupid. Let me put it that way. They're stupid people. And I would, we would get in these conversations and I would press them on the details. And, you know, all Republicans, they lynched black people and they did this, this, and that. I'm like, no, you do know that the Confederates were all Democrats. And you do know that the KKK was all Democrat, with the exception of Indiana, which is really weird to me, and I still can't figure it out. In Indiana, for some reason, the KKK was Republican. But other than that...
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Say what?
I did not know that.
Most people don't know that. And you know what? One of these days, I got to write a book about that. Why out of... I think it's because, you know, in Indiana, they're known for their love of basketball. And I guess they realize that when they take over basketball.
Yeah, maybe that's it. I think you're onto something right now.
they better lynch them before they take over basketball. While they all these things out, and they would be looking at me like, I don't want to say that, you know, well, how can I put it? They would look at me like they didn't have a clue. And I would tell them, I said, y'all problem is you guys are just thoughtless. You don't go beyond what somebody told you. I said, I'm sorry. If before I change my mind on something, I have to do all my research. So, you know, you can imagine I didn't have the best of time in newsrooms.
Oh, yeah.
I know. As a matter of fact, here's the thing about it. I'll be very brief. I worked at the Daily Herald here in Chicago. And I took on the newsroom once over something. I don't even know what it was. But as I was walking back to my desk, a couple of the white sports reporters pulled me aside and said, we wish we had the courage that you have to stand up for what you know is right. And I said, well, why don't y'all? They said, because they'll fire us. I'm like, well, they can't fire me. Matter of fact, I actually was told by my editor to go back to Africa.
What?
Yes.
No.
The Daily Herald in Arlington Heights, Illinois, that's a suburb of Chicago, she told me to go back to Africa. She told me to go hang out with this guy that was in jail who called everybody niggas. She constantly did it. Anyway, I went to Human Resources, did the right thing. They did an investigation. It turns out what I said was true. Then they made us sign these agreements that we would, whatever the outcome was, we could not express. We could not tell everybody else what happened. And they moved me to another job I didn't want. Then they said that if somebody speaks out about this, beyond this, they'll be fired. Well, the white blonde-haired woman went and told everybody. So when I found out, I went to Human Resources, you know what they told me? Well, there's nothing we can do about it. So I said, I guess that NDA, whatever you want to call it, you know, non-disclosure agreement.
Yeah, right.
That don't apply to the black guy.
No.
And they got quiet. Because you know what? If I did it, they would have fired my ass right there on the spot. And this is all fully documented. You can call the Daily Herald and ask them. So that's after incredible. That, I said, screw you attitude at my job. They couldn't fire me. So anyway, that's my story.
What year were you born? And what was your current age?
Okay, 57.
Same here. Same here. Same age.
Right.
So we both of us have ran into discrimination, you know, and I can tell you, I mean, I've been through some things that it's because you're black. That's what it is. It's all because you're black and that they treat you differently. You know, that you're kind of like the odd man out. Depends on what kind of industry you work in. You know, I'm sure just the same as you. I was the only black guy in a lot of situations on the scene and seeing whatever I entered. And that's where I had to deal with that. So that's the reason I wrote my book, because I had issues that I ran into that I didn't think should have existed.
And that's true. We're kindred spirits in that result. And that,
right.
You know, I used to push the boundaries. Like, okay, I'm a writer. I have a great respect for words, right? I refuse to say N-word. I refuse to say whatever words, like I'm a child. So in the newsroom, I would be walking around saying, nigga this and nigga that. I didn't know how to handle that.
No.
We can't very well fire him for saying the N-word.
Because they might be saying that behind your back anyway.
As a matter of fact, I was in a meeting being disciplined, and my direct editor was right there, and he said, well, some people are uncomfortable with you saying the N-word. I'm like, what's the N-word? I said, no, I'm not. What's the N-word? I'm the best to get them to say it. But they're like, Perry, just go to your desk and do your job. Anyway, that's it.
Go back into your little place.
Yeah, so. Go back into your little cubbyhole. But anyway, just like you, the book you wrote, I wrote it from a different angle.
Uh-huh.
I wanted to focus on the humor.
Yes.
Love, the camaraderie, growing up in a Black community.
Uh-huh.
And in that regard, my book is very unique because I did my research before I wrote it. I just wanted to know, has anybody else ever did this? Because, you and I grew up in the same era. We remember George Wallace, segregation, Jim Crow. But think about your childhood. You had a lot of good times, I bet.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I had some great times, and I can be honest with you. Growing up, as a result of my childhood, I never wanted to leave the Black community. I never felt more at home and safe and secure as I did in Black communities. My buddies and I, we would travel to other towns to party. We'd go to the local McDonald's, the nearest McDonald's, walk up to the Black people and say, hey, where the ghetto at? They tell us, and that's exactly where we went. Hey, where's the ghetto, man? What? We in town. We just want to know where the ghetto's at. And they would tell us.
Yeah. You know, I had that experience. See, I grew up military brat, so I never lived in the hood. So I'm a little different, a lot different. That's why, you know, they call me Oreo or whatever. Not really Black. Not quite white. So this happened to me. I was working at Rickenbacker, and some guy from active duty from the Thunderbirds, one of the crew chiefs, came to me and said, hey, where the hood at?
Like, you know, he was, you know what, was he, you said with the Thunderbird, right?
Yeah.
You know, I interviewed a guy, a Black pilot with the Thunderbirds, probably in 1980? No. That would have been 89.
That's about the time. That's about the time.
I was so impressed with him. Actually, it was a very good story. I must say so myself. But I wrote a story about him, and he was. It was such an honor to meet him.
That's awesome.
And I was in the military too. I was in the Air Force.
Oh, okay.
I was in
same the Air here.
Force, but I wasn't in there very long. I got a medical discharge. I'm fine. Yeah. I tell everybody, then he said, why were you only there for 6 months? And I said, I got a major injury from an azalea bush I was cutting.
Oh.
And they discharged me.
Dangerous azalea bushes. Watch out.
Yeah, watch out. But I will be quite honest with you. I'm proud of, people will say, well, you weren't in there long. I said, that's not the point.
No.
Actually, no. Volunteered, and I took the oath.
Yes.
I took the oath. And as far as I'm concerned, I won't compare myself to people like you who did it extended and people who did combat, went to combat, were wounded and stuff. I can't do that.
Well, here's the thing. Here's the thing about it. You took that step. You joined. That means everything. Doesn't matter what happens to you when you get in. You went to basic training. Did all this stuff, and that says a lot. A lot of people won't do that or can't do that. Some people won't do, but you did.
Family, we served in all branches.
Yes, and you're a veteran now, right? Is that correct?
Yeah, I'm a veteran. I'm a veteran.
That's right. That's all that matters. So what did you do in the Air Force? What was your?
AFSC? I was a communication specialist, but most of what I did was lie in a hospital bed.
Wow,
that's mostly what I did. Well, they would, since I wasn't really injured, they would make me clean the hospital. It was Wilford Hall. So I was You know Wilford Hall?
Oh, yeah. I do.
Cleaning crew, because they were like, we're not going to have you just laying up here doing nothing while we figure out what we're going to do. So I would help clean the hospital. So,
all right.
It's been an interesting time in my life.
Yeah. So you didn't get out of basic then? Is that what you're saying?
I made it out of basic.
Yeah.
I never I was like 5 weeks in basic and my blood pressure hit. To danger zone, and they no matter what they do, they could not make it come down.
Wow.
To make a long story short, then one day after months, they said, well, we're going to just have to discharge you. Go see a doctor immediately. Bah, bah, bah. Moving on. It turns out I have what is known as white coat syndrome.
Gotcha. Whenever,
yeah, my blood pressure spikes when I'm in a medical setting.
Yeah. That used to happen to me all the time, and I'm nervous about my blood pressure being tested. Yeah, that's white coat. Yeah, I'm white familiar coat. With that.
And
yeah,
so what it was, and at the time, nobody knew what it was.
Uh huh. Yeah, yeah, it's real.
No one had ever heard of white coat syndrome. I had never heard of it, and now I'm on a mild, diuretic for my blood pressure. But now, when I go to doctors, I have to explain to them. Just let me rest here for a little while before you take my blood pressure.
Yes.
I get used to it. They take it as normal. But at the time, they didn't know what it was.
I'm going to give you a little tip because I had the same problem. I take 200 milligrams of CoQ10.
It
drops my pressure within 60 minutes. Okay. You actually see your pulse drop that fast. And that's what controls my blood pressure.
I'm going to have to try that.
I did like 200 milligrams. So yeah, try that out. And I do medical hacking on the side, by the way. I had to learn stuff the hard way. So I got kicked out as well. I got kicked out after 29 and a half years. So.
Oh, man, you were close to retirement.
I did. I got to retire. I'm retired.
Well, you got the retirement.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Now, which branch again were you in?
Air Force.
Oh, you're Air Force. So you know Lackland. And,
yes. Uh-huh. That was a good time. Those were good times, And you know.
Well, you know what? We might have been in there at the same time.
Yeah, you're right.
You know what I like about Lackland was watching the planes in the, they would start, say, about 4 or 5 o'clock, and they would come flying into the base.
I mean,
huge planes.
C-5s, yep.
Yeah, they would come flying into the base. And I remember one day I was walking somewhere, parade field or something, and the hairs on the back of my head stood up.
And yeah.
What the heck is this? And I heard this. It was an A-10.
Oh, wow. It
right over me. I was like, man. The guts to fly one of those things. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I worked on an A-10 once. I worked on a Thunderbird once.
Okay.
And different things. Things you get to see. F-111. Never got on an F-4. But some of the things you do, I was electrician or electrical systems.
Right.
Specialist. At the age of 19, I worked on fighter jets. I started working on it. I'm like,
wow.
But where else can you do that? You can't do that anywhere else. But
nowhere else but the Air Force.
But you I hope you got some VA stuff lined up.
I did.
Okay, good. Thank you for your service. I'm going to tell you this. Thank you for your service.
Although I go to private hospitals.
Yes, you're a very wise man.
I want to live. I used to go to the hospital, Loyola University Medical Center.
I did there. Great.
It was next to a VA. What? It was right next to a VA hospital. And pressed for the VA hospital. And then when I had to go to see a doctor, I went to my doctor at Loyola, and people are like, well, why don't you go to the VA? I'm like, because I want to live.
ditto. Been there, done that. It gets worse. It's never gotten any better because government.
And that's one of the things, that's why I'm against universal health care.
Right.
Yeah.
Government doesn't do things better than the private world. Nothing. They don't do anything.
And that's sad.
Except for drop bombs and kill people. That's what they're really good at. But
kill people and break things. They do.
Yes.
Grew up with that. When you talk about friendly fire.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're from Syracuse.
Syracuse, New York.
By way of Ohio, right?
Yeah, I was born in Akron, Ohio. And I don't know if you had a chance to at least look at some of my manuscript.
Yes, I have.
I was born in Akron, Ohio, and then we spirited away in the night during the day, and we ended up in Syracuse, New York. So that's where I grew up at, and that's what I call it my forever home. You know, I love Syracuse.
Yeah, Akron. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I was in Akron like sometime last year. Isn't that where the Ernest Angley Church is?
Oh yeah, I used to watch him every day because he made me laugh.
Yes, me too, baby. Okay, there's this. I'm telling you, this is like the best kept secret in Ohio. Down the street is some place called the Blue Door Cafe.
Okay.
They have the best breakfast I've ever had, and I've been all over the world.
Oh, wow.
You ever get a chance to go there? I mean, it's like, and it's reservations, it's packed in there, and people with really nice cars go there all the time. So we actually got to eat there one day, and it was like incredible.
The Blue Door Cafe?
Yes.
Okay, I'm in Akron frequently, so okay. I still have a lot of family there, and my wife, but I'm going to check it out.
Blue Door Cafe, it's on that same road that church is on. Angel's
Church. I forget the name of it, but
Cathedral of Tomorrow, is that right? I don't remember what it is, but anyway.
I forget what it was, but my family was surprised that I was watching Ernest religiously. They're like,
yes.
Look at him. And he would say, seducing demons. I would tell him, I'm vexed by the seducing demons. Oh God! And then, of course, that toupee he wore was obviously a toupee. And I'm like, I mean, the guy's got guts,
right? Yes, but you know what? I could not watch it.
Bay.
I had to watch it. It was like riveting. My mom watched it too. It's like, wow.
You know what? I mean, my attitude is, if I, you know, it was a church I could have attended.
Right. Yeah.
Because I would have been so amused. Shameless, because you knew he was in it for the money.
Yes, but it's okay.
Oh my God, I miss him.
Yes. Yeah, you know, and it's Ohio and everything. So from Ohio, you move to, you know, yeah, so you moved to New York, Syracuse.
Syracuse, New York.
And that's where you grew up, right?
I grew up in Syracuse, New York. We got there probably in 60. It was the year 64 is when we got there. Because actually, the thing about my book is, it seemed like a long time that I lived there, but it was 20 years, and I just thought, oh wow, what a perfect! It was just perfect for literary purposes.
Yeah,
and it was. Because I, you know, the one thing people ask me, they would say to me, you have such a good memory. And I've always had a memory better than most. But also it's because when I was in college, you know, I had an English literary and it was a professor in a creative writing course. And I wrote a story about pets that we used to own. And I handed it in, and my professor was so impressed. She came to me and said, I got to see you after class. So after class, she asked me, did you plagiarize that story? I didn't even know what plagiarize meant.
Yeah, right.
But I knew that it didn't sound right. So I said, no, I didn't plagiarize it. So then she said, James Thurber. I thought it was some of his work. So I went through all his collected works. She said, I haven't found anything similar.
Oh, wow.
I'm going to let you know that I know that came out of your head. And she says, how? And I said, I don't know. It's the way I've always thought. I don't care what there is in life, even tragedy, there's humor in it. Yes. And that, for some reason, that's what I always picked up on. So somebody would die and people would come to me all morose. And then we would start talking about their life, and they would say something to me, and I would start laughing. They're like, how could you do it? I'm like, that's funny. it's funny. And sorry, I see the humor in it. Well, anyway, that's when I started jotting down notes in that course. And I just, memories, whatever it was, I jotted down notes and I kept them. And I knew one day I was going to tell the story. So basically, that's what it was. It's this wide sweeping story. Some of it is personal. A lot of it, if not most of it, is about people I knew growing up. This is white, mainly black, but also white, Native American. And because Syracuse is next to the Onondaga Indian Reservation, so I made a lot of Indian, Native American friends. So that's what it was. And it actually is two books. I had written so much that I was over 1,000 pages, and I spoke to an editor. He says, that's easy. Just cut in half. That's what I did. So I'm working on the next one. I'm working on the next one, which is yet untitled, because I don't think you can beat my main title, the first title.
Right.
So Half Moons, Pickle Pig Feet, Malt Liquor, and Menthols and Luck. Yeah, Malt Liquor and Menthols. So it's Half Moon, Pickle Pig Feet, Malt Liquor, and Menthols. And each word has a meaning.
Yes.
Half Moons had to do with a type of cookie that you can only get in upstate New York. And then Pickle Pig Feet, Malt Liquor, and Menthol. Anybody who grew up in a black community knows that black people ate them some Pickle Pig Feet. During my time, the beer they drank was Colt 45, Malt Liquor, and the cigarettes they smoked were all Menthols.
Yeah.
So that's where the title comes from.
Very interesting. It's very catchy too. I like that.
I had one person call me and said they're going to nominate it for title of the year when it's published.
Yeah. Yes. So your plans are to publish it this spring. Is that correct?
Yeah, this spring. That's my plan, to publish it this spring. And I want to start out first in Akron, Ohio, and upstate New York, and hope to build some type of buzz on it, and then go national. And like I said, it's a unique book. And my main plan is I'd like to have it turned into either I want to start working on turning it into a stage play, and then looking to pitch it as a TV show. It's unique, and I did my research before I wrote it, because I just wanted to make sure it was, and every story in it is true, because I've always been a storyteller, a raconteur. I've always been a storyteller, and when I tell a story, I tell it truthfully, but I punch it up to make it interesting, because most people I run into, they can't tell a story. I always say, right, the problem is you stick too close to the facts. They're like, what? So I would tell somebody, so what you just told me, that happened that way? I said, yeah, the way I remembered it. And that's how I remembered it. So
I'm glad you did research. That's very important. You know, just like you, my book's about my life, yours is about yours, but I still had to do research for things that related to it,
right,
put it together. And it's got to be clear, and it's got to be accurate. I don't want anybody to go back and say, hey, this wasn't true. Even though with my life, I have people in it, you know, there are people in it that I interacted with. So it's very important.
Well, it is. I did my research, and what I wrote was not to insult anybody, to cause anybody any harm. I wanted to tell the story of a black community in an upstate New York City, and at least the part of the black community that I knew. That was important to me. And it was also important to me to let people know, especially white people, to know that, you know, we didn't all march in civil rights riots and have fire hoses turned on us and police dogs sicked on us.
Right.
Back in the 60s and the 70s. Oh, no, we didn't. As a matter of fact, for the most part, we were not unlike white people and any other people in this country.
Right.
We had our challenges. There were things, like I said, you know, money was short,
mm-hmm.
but the love wasn't.
Right.
The fun wasn't. Man, I had a great time during my childhood. I had a great time, even in the midst of the riots and the segregation and the hatred. I had a damn good time. I did. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I had a good time. And sometimes looking back at that, when people talk about the 60s, you know, they talk about it like we were all oppressed and put
right.
up. I didn't notice it. And, you know,
right. that
was
it.
Once back in the 60s, Stokely Carmichael was being interviewed on radio, on television, and he's talking about the riots and this, and that. And I'm sitting there with my family. And then at one point, he says, "Hey, look, as black people, we ain't afraid to die for what we believe in." I turned around and said, "Everybody but me." And everybody started laughing. I'm not gonna die for what I believe in.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. He's on his own. Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. So you have how many brothers and sisters that you have?
Okay, I grew up, I have let me see. That would be 13. Oh no, that's 11, 12. 12 brothers and 3 sisters, but 4 of the kids come from my mom remarried, and then he brought 4 kids to the family. I grew up in a huge house,
mm-hmm.
and always had companionships, always had people to play with, always had people to war with. Because, you know, when you have that many kids, yeah. But no, it was a great childhood. It really was. It was a great childhood growing up, and that's why that was the purpose of the book. The purpose of the book was to say, "Hey, look, as black people, we had a lot of joy growing up. We really did. And when it came to things like racism, I have to be honest with you, I barely noticed it.
Yeah."
If I hadn't watched the news, I wouldn't even know what was going on. And, you know, then years later, when I became a reporter and I ended up in Tuskegee, you know, Tuskegee was a center of the civil rights movements. I even knew Rosa Parks. And people are like, "How did you know Rosa Parks?" I said, first, she was born in Tuskegee. So one year, the city, Johnny Ford, one of the first black mayors in Alabama, who was celebrated back in the 60s, when he won elections, they had a birthday party for 78. I forget what year it was. But anyway, that's when I met her. So I met her. She knew me by name. I knew her by name.
Nice.
Was they had a party at the city hall, and they had these kegs with beer in them. And the funny thing was, black people, it was mainly black people, they would walk up to the keg and they would look at it, they'd pick up the thing and they couldn't figure out how to work it. So now, I went to high school and college with white people, and one thing about white people, they know how to work a keg. So my roommate Gary, who also went to high school, and he was black, went to high school and black people, went to high school with white people, went to college with white people, we both went over, and so we worked the keg at Rose Park's birthday party.
No way. She's a historical.
Yeah, she thinks it was so funny watching people walking up and picking the thing up, looking at it, didn't know what to do. And matter of fact, the rest of the story was, so at the end of the party, one of the kegs was still full. So me and Gary took it back to our apartment and we stuck it in the bathtub. Why we stuck it in the bathtub, I don't know. So we're drinking this beer all through the weekend, and other people were coming over and drinking a beer. And then the police chief called us and said, "We're missing a keg. Do you know anything about it?"
And all absolutely nothing.
We were like, "Well, one followed us home." And then they were going to bring it back, or they were going to issue an arrest warrant for us for theft. So
wow.
That's what I mean by the type of stories I tell.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's a great story. You got the element of historical figure, and you have party, then you have something that you shouldn't have done.
Yeah, something I shouldn't have done. Arrest us.
So you were in Tuskegee, Alabama, correct?
Yeah, Tuskegee, Alabama.
So, yeah, we worked with that fighter unit down there quite a bit.
And at the what?
The fighter unit, F-16 unit.
Oh, yeah, that's the, you're talking about, oh, yeah, the fighter unit, not, unit down there. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, they actually painted some of their tails are red tails. Red because, tails. Yeah, because they're the, yeah.
I know a lot of the surviving Tuskegee Airmen.
Yeah.
There was one named Colonel Chief Anderson, wonderful man. Back in the 40s, when Eleanor Roosevelt came to visit the Tuskegee Airmen, there's a famous photo of Chief Anderson taking her up for a flight, right before he took her up for a flight. Wow. I wish you could have met Chief Anderson. He was matter of fact, when I got to Tuskegee, my editor said, you got to go see Chief Anderson. So I went over there and knocked on the door, and I told him, oh, I'm with Tuskegee. I'm Tuskegee News. You know what he said to me? Come on, let's go for a flight.
Oh, man. Oh, my God.
And he was in his 80s. I was nervous as hell.
No, I bet.
I'm nervous as hell. This is a man who was largely forgotten. But if not for him, there would have never been the Tuskegee Airmen. If not, because right. He put Eleanor Roosevelt up for a flight.
Wow. Landed,
and that's when she went back and she told her husband, you're going to fund these pilots.
Whoa.
But this is a man who's lost to history. So, yeah. And then I met Fred Gray, who was Martin Luther King's lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
Met him and... you know, he was a great man. When I was in Tuskegee, I worked for the Daily World, Atlanta Daily World, which is the oldest continuously publishing black newspaper in the country. And I met C.A. Scott, they're all Republican. They were all Republicans, which is why you don't hear about the Daily World.
Yeah, right.
I remember sitting in the seat. I mean, he had to be 90 something years old. And I was sitting in the seat, and he said, you see that seat you're sitting in? I'm like, yeah. He said, "That you know who sat there?" I'm like, who? He said, Dr. Martin Luther King sat there. He came to me a couple of days before he went to Memphis, and I told him, don't go.
Oh,
don't
wow.
go. And he said, don't go there because you won't come back alive. And he said, you know what happened. And then he hired me.
Wow.
Yeah, so I met him, Coretta Scott King, a whole bunch of them, Hosea Williams, Jesse Jackson on a number of occasions,
mm-hmm.
who's taller than most people think he is. But he has these very intense beady eyes. Very intense. I could see why the man got to where he was because he was looking at me and I thought he was doing like a proctological exam or something through my face. Oh, man.
Yeah, right. That's hilarious.
That was true. Just beady, and he just bores right in on you. Amazing. But yeah, I met a whole bunch of those people, and I may write about them sometimes. Someday.
Yeah. Yeah, sounds like you're very talented. You got a lot of history. You got professional, and now you're doing your own thing.
That's it.
So, yeah.
At some point, you know, I went to work for the University of Chicago, which was the biggest mistake of my life professionally, because they're all a bunch of liberals.
Yeah.
Tommy lived, and it didn't work out. It really didn't work out. And so I left, and then I kind of did this and did that. I was doing freelance, and I still do a lot of freelance for you know, the Will County Republican Party and who else, people running for office. But mm-hmm. Damn it, I'm just going to write this damn thing. And so I finally did it. I finally got it. It's going through the final edits because, you know, I didn't have the money to hire a professional editor because that's a lot of money.
Right.
So the way I did it, I wrote it, then I would edit it. So I would write, then edit. I would write, wait 3-4 months, then edit.
Uh-huh.
Write some, rewrite, wait a month, then edit. So, because that's one thing about, you know this, that all writing is basically, all good writing is rewriting.
Yes.
That's what it is. So as an editor, I would come back and I would look to see what needed to be rewritten. And then I would come back to it as a writer. And then, okay, thank you, editor. I'm going to change this, change this, change that. So it went back and forth, back and forth. But now it's like the final edits, you know, to remove some duplication. Because I have this tendency to move this here and put this here. And then I'm like, wait a minute, I forgot to delete that. So that's where I'm at right now. So I'm working with the master file for my my layout guy. I'm working with the master file and finishing up all those last minute edits, and we'll see how it goes. And you know, I've told my wife, you know, even if I sell 100 copies, I'm going to be happy because the story is out there. It's up to people if they want to hear it, if they want to read it.
Yeah, I could see that, and you know, with this interview, I've learned so much more about you as a person. And how you think and your skills. So tell us about your PR skills, because that's another thing that is very useful.
Well, it's very extensive. I went from, I told you I was at the Daily Herald, and that's when that app, well, back to Africa stuff. And I was so frustrated. I went to, I accepted a job at the Green Bay Press Gazette. And no, I'm not a fan of the Packers. I was a Metro editor up there. And then, you know, I got frustrated. And so I quit the job, came back, found a job at Loyola University Medical Center as a, what was it? I was a senior communication specialist or whatever the heck it was.
Right.
Think about the best PR people are former journalists, because we know how journalists work. We know when to call a journalist. We know how to pitch a story.
Wow.
And the person that hired me was Ann Dillon, and she hired me. She headed the department, and she said, the reason I'm hiring you is because there was a whole lot of other PR specialists who came here, and she said, they don't know how journalists work. He says, but you're a journalist for 20 years. You know how to get their attention. And so I went to work, and this is in a medical center, so I covered everything. I mean, you know, things like you know, it was topical things, like if there was a killing and we had a patient there and we had a doctor that could talk, it was my job to put him in contact with the doctor while he conducted the interview. We did crisis communications and all the communications you can think of. And then we were pitching stories about the nurses and the doctors and the services. Matter of fact, I was so good at what I did. I was probably the best in Chicago in that period. I mean, I got so much news coverage. Matter of fact, Fox News did a day-long segment popping in and out on a story that I wrote and pitched. It was about seven. We had seven nurses who volunteered to donate kidneys under our, we called it, what was the program that was Pay It Forward Kidney Program. The name I gave it based on the book. I contacted the writer of the Pay It Forward book, who said, great, you guys can use the title for your kidney research program. So anyway, transplant program. I did that, and it just blew everything away. I mean, it just blew everything away, but that's what I was. I was a very good PR professional. Everything that you can do in public relations, I did it. Then I went to the University of Chicago, and I actually worked the same job that Michelle Obama had, but they didn't pay me $300,000 a year.
Oh.
You know, that was one of those, basically working a no-show job.
Oh, wow.
Now, matter of fact, I became very close to Obama's best friend, Dr. Eric Whitaker. We became very close. I had his personal number and everything. He says, I want to take you to meet Obama. Like, I don't know if that's going to work.
Whoa.
I don't think so.
You better be nice.
I know. I would have to be nice. and that would have been really nice. But if you know anything about Chicago, that's how Chicago operates. You know, you just see that the city just elected a socialist for his next mayor. And I have nothing but I grieve for the city. Yeah. I really do. This people have no idea. I mean, the amount of vacancies in downtown offices, the violence, the lack of respect for authority. Chicago's going the way of Detroit.
That's really sad because, you know, the people, or did they vote for him or did it? They get the votes. Did they get the votes or did they people vote for them? That's what I want to know.
Well, you know, Chicago, they have a saying, you might have heard it in Chicago, vote early, vote often.
Yes. That's a scary thing.
But both sides do it.
Yeah. Absolutely.
That's how they do it.
Well, there are no sides. It's whoever gets the most, you know, in the box. Wins. Whoever counts the votes makes it happen. That's the problem.
That's it. So that's it. And so I'm not surprised that happened to Chicago. And, you know, because, you know, we have a large black population concentrated in the South and the West sides. And that's kind of hard to overcome. I mean, it really is, because they vote as a block.
Yes.
And if you ever been to, I tell people, they'll say, hey, look, I want to go see Chicago. Can I go see the source, go over to the black community? I'm like, no, you can't. And they look at me like, what? I was like, you taking your life in your hands. And I mean this with all sincerity. When you go to the north, the south and west sides of Chicago, predominantly black, you are literally taking your life in your hands. It's not like it used to be anymore. It really isn't. I did some Uber driving to make some extra money.
Uh-oh.
I had to stop it. Then people are like, what? Yeah. And I'm like, the violence used to be confined to the South and the West side, but after the George Floyd riot, it spilled over northwards all across the city. And we're talking about, I don't care how upscale a community is, in Chicago, you are not completely safe. You're really not.
Yeah, I've been to Chicago a few times. There are sketchy parties. I'm not afraid of Chicago. I'm afraid of East Chicago.
Oh, East Chicago?
Yeah. That whole Indiana area is scary to me. But,
yes. That's considered the far south suburbs.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, it's considered the far south suburbs. And it's sad. I mean, it is sad. I can tell you a story. When I was at the University of Chicago, 5 o'clock, I got off work. I was driving, I forget the name of the street, but I'm driving down the street. Now, this is 5 o'clock, broad daylight.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I come to this red light, and I look to the left, and there's this young boy laying halfway in and out the street, face down with a white t-shirt that was covered in blood. Ooh. And I looked at this and I could not believe I was seeing this. I still don't believe that I was seeing it. I happened to arrive probably a minute after this boy had been riddled with bullets and killed. So the light turns green and I was so shocked, I just sat there. So next thing you know, the police showed up. Of course, I get pulled aside. What did I see? And I said, I didn't see anything. I just saw the boy laying there. I didn't hear shots. I didn't hear anything.
Yeah.
Turns out the boy was 13 years old. And the kid that shot him was 14 years old. It was tragic.
Yeah, it makes you wonder why. Why would he, what led up to that? Why would anybody even think about?
Well, I think you know this. It's the lack of fathers.
Yes. Yes.
The one thing I emphasize in my book is the importance of fathers. I grew up with a stepfather who probably wasn't the most ideal person. In other words, he wasn't a Mike Brady, right? Yes,
right.
He, you know what? If you got out of line, before giving you a lecture, he'd go right upside your head.
Mm-hmm.
But look how many kids he had to watch over. I resented him for years until I realized that all of us turned out pretty good. And mainly it's because we respected his authority.
Yes.
Yeah. Matter of fact, the funniest thing he used to do, he would do two things. One of them was when I became a teenager and before me and my brothers and them went out to hang out for the weekend, you know, weekend and stuff, he'd line us up and he would look at us and he would say, when you guys get out there tonight, I don't care what you do. You can rape, rob, and steal. Hit a woman in the head, steal their purse. He said, but I promise you, if I find out that you did any of that, there's going to be one less nappy-headed nigger walking around this neighborhood. And he says, and I mean that. And then he would go sit back down. And he was so matter of fact. And he would say it almost devoid of emotion. You knew he meant it. And the other thing he used to do is, just out of the blue, he'd rap you upside the head. And we're like, what's that for? He said, because that's what the crap you're doing I don't know about. He said, so I'm going to let you know.
Oh, man. It'll
just go 100 times worse for you if I find out about it. Wow. So you better think about that. And he'd walk away. I was terrified of the man.
So, yeah, that's a deterrent. I mean, he actually got you guys in line.
He got us in line. This is not an original statement from me, but I was watching this guy on some internet channel. And it was this black male. He was probably in his 40s. And he talked about when he was a kid, my father used to be really harsh on us. And he said, and then my mom interceded. And he says, my father said, okay, if you want to raise him that your way, you raise him your way. And all of them went to jail. And he said that he blamed his mom for it. And he said, because he remember, he said, what he would say to my mom is, sometimes you have to half kill a Negro to make him do right.
Yeah. Right.
And I understood the sentiment. The sentiment was, he didn't want to do it. He really didn't want to. But at some point, he realized that his kids had to have a respect for authority. And the only way he could show that respect was physically. That's the way he showed that respect. He transmitted that respect physically. I'm sorry, my wife. Did you want something?
Walmart.
Go ahead. Get me some aspirins, thank you. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. My wife is standing there looking at me, and I'm like, okay, she wants something. Okay. Yeah, and she was like saying, wrap it up, get out of here. But no, anyway, so that's it with me. And when I write, I like to write about those things, and I like to do it in a way that's entertaining and gets to the heart of it, because to me, I like to look at the true nature of who we are as human beings.
Oops. I lost him.
But no, I don't want to sugarcoat it, but I do like, I like to look at the humor of it all.
Yeah.
And, right. And the underlying thing of what makes us as Black.
Oops. He's going out. Be back. Okay. You okay? You good?
I'm fine.
Okay, good. All right. I agree with you. I know in your book, things, you know, yes, he wasn't the greatest dad.
No, he wasn't.
Nicest. He wasn't Mr. Nice Guy. My dad wasn't either, you know, so.
He was military, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that explains that.
Here's the thing about it, though. It wasn't your parents on the base, you know, they didn't have to really do anything. Cause if you messed up as a child, they talked to your father. If you were racist, they talked to your dad. Your dad was responsible. His career was on the line. So,
yes.
And then, you know, in the civilian world in Columbus, Ohio was like a day and night because we didn't have that same thing. There was very divisive between Blacks and whites. So I had to learn to cope with that because it blew my mind. It's like, everybody's the same, but they're not. So I was living in a fantasy world, but you were not because your dad told you. And that's really, and my favorite is Gregory Mama.
Oh, yeah. She was a wonderful woman. I wish you could have known her. She was, when they talked about a liberated woman, they had my grandmother in mind. She was one of the most influential people in my life. And, you know, she was a mixed race, but she was, her father was Irish. At least that's the latest story. Yeah. And her mother was black. And for years, it never occurred to me that she looked more white than she looked black. Wow. I just said she was my grandmother. That was it.
Yeah.
But Gregory Mama was when she passed, that was a great loss. It really was. But
I could tell she was a very big part.
Yep. Very big part of my life.
Yeah.
Very big part of my life. And a woman who did not believe in sparing the belt. That woman lit me up so many times.
Yep, I got the belt. I got the belt too. I got the hand. I got the belt. Whatever was around.
Yeah, that was it. Whatever was in within, whatever was in arm's reach, I got. Yes,
right.
Matter of fact, people would always praise my mom and Gregory Mama about your kids are so well behaved. And you're like, if you only knew why.
If you knew the consequences. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there were always consequences.
Yeah. One day I said, Mom, you're crazy. And you don't say crazy to the older generation. You don't.
Nope.
My dad picked me up. You don't ever call your brother crazy. And I'm like, but in my generation, it didn't mean the same thing, you know? So you got to be careful. You got to know what their limits are so you can survive.
Well, their limits were, you know, it was, it bothers me that there's not more black parents like that.
Right.
And that more black kids didn't experience that. The one thing I've always told people that, because I had white friends who had never been spanked. Ooh. Oh, my parents never spanked me. And I was like, then how'd they keep you in line? They're like, what are you talking about? They would just talk to me. Mm. What? That was alien.
Yeah, that's foreign.
Yeah, that was foreign to me. And I'm not saying people should run out and start beating their kids. I'm not saying anything like that. What I'm saying was that was my experience. And my experience was, and it's mainly through fathers. A good father knows it's his job to civilize his sons without breaking their spirits. You don't want to break a boy's spirit.
Oh, yeah, right.
But you have to civilize them. And that's a delicate balance. And some black men back then were very good at doing that. They didn't want to go upside your head. But when you get caught shoplifting, you know it was wrong. Sitting you down, giving you a lecture, matter of fact, you might have heard this. They said, oh, you smelling yourself now. You got those little bitty muscles, right?
Yeah.
You think you can go against what I say you're supposed to do. Yeah. Father would roll his sleeves up and say, come on.
Wow.
I did that with my father and got my butt whooped.
Wow.
Never did it again. It happened once, didn't need to happen again. Because, you know, I knew what was right and wrong, and they made sure that it was enforced. There were times they went light on me. You know, they would say, you know, Negro, I ought to, but I'm going to give you a pass this time, but you better, the next time it happens, next time it would happen, it was all on me.
The next time, yeah.
It was all
this on me. Better not happen again.
Yeah, better not happen again. Yeah, I got to let go with that.
Yeah.
And like I said, it was, this is what I write about. These are the things that I find amusing now. You know, family reunions, you know, when I'm around my dad and my mom and everything, we all laugh about all that. Because when my kids came, it was suddenly, don't hit that boy.
<I'm> like, <"What?" laughs> Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Like, what are you talking about?
Oh, they can do it all wrong. You're right, just let them go. Yeah,
let them
be my grandkids.
I don't know, but it was, and I just wanted to bring that aspect of black life. I wanted to write about that because, like I tell people, I had a great childhood. I had a great child. Yeah, there were ups and downs. There were disappointments. But once again, there was a lot of love. There was a lot of laughter. There was a lot of camaraderie. I never had friends as close as I had then.
Right. I mean,
these were great guys. And, you know, guys I could depend on. I never did it. You know, and I write about that. I write about my, I think you probably read about when I accidentally stabbed my math teacher. It ended up in a jail cell. I was 16 years old.
That's trauma. No, that's traumatic.
Especially when they told us how they searched for contraband.
Yep.
I was like, you're kidding, right?
They call them rape cages these days.
I was like, you're kidding, right? No, we're not. Like, oh my God.
And that's their standard thing, you know?
Yep.
Very, very little people would even try to do that. You know, it's not normal, but that's what they do.
That's what they had to do. So I spent a few hours in the county lockup, and then I got suspended. I got expelled. I got expelled from the entire school district, and I ended up going to this school with special needs because under New York State law, they still had to educate me. So I ended up at this school with special needs kids where I set the curve on every test. Right. And this is not to make fun of them. They were some great kids. I made some great friendships. I really admired them because despite their challenges, they were doing everything they could to get the best education that they could. So I inspired them. But anyway, after that, I got big confrontations with one of the teachers there. And then I stopped going to school again. And I ended up hanging out with this pimp. So for about a month, I rode around with this pimp while he conducted his business. Well, of course, when my parents found out about it, they weren't happy about that. And they're like, what is it with you? And I was like, I can't help it if people just like me. I can't help it. So anyway, that's if people want to know more about stories like that, they can read the book.
Yeah, so tell everybody where they can... Okay.
Well, I don't know yet because the book is like about 3 weeks away from being officially published.
Yes, but when the book comes out.
What I will do is I'll come back on your show when I let
you know. When the book comes out, I want to have you on and we'll talk some more and we can talk. Then we can show people where it is and you know, I'll advertise it too.
So I'd appreciate that.
Yeah, I support authors. I love authors. Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
So published authors, once you get this done, it's perfect. So I know what you're going through. Your book is a high difficulty one because there's a lot in there and it takes a lot to put it together. And I'll just tell you this, my book, I had it written a certain way and the editor changed titles and then she changed the order. And it worked out perfectly. So you never know.
We never know. We'll see.
Yeah.
All right, then. I got to run.
All right. I'll talk to you later. You have a good one.
You take care.
All right.
Bye.
Later. Bye. Yeah, that was pretty awesome. Perry Drake. He's an author. He has a book coming in the spring. So you never know yet if Brownie Fox will publish it. But I've read a lot of it. It's really good. So that'll do it for tonight's show. And thanks, Doobie, for coming on. Thanks, everybody, for watching, for liking it. Jonathan Carlson. Yeah, that's it. Rory Slaughter. Got your own show going on right now. So appreciate it. I'll probably be joining Rory this Friday. This Friday, I'll be there. Be on his program. So thanks a lot, everyone. And God bless. Have a great evening. Signing out. Thank you. Goodbye.